Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode number 63 for November 2015. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we get together every month or so, and we get people from different countries, cultures around the world, and we discuss the things that have been happening in the past month, hopefully giving you a vision of each event that is maybe not completely aligned with the one you might have already. So broadening horizons. At least, you know, that's what we try to do. Usually, it descends into me and Turkey arguing about, I don't know, which restaurant, which city has better restaurants between Belgium, you know,
I never
Brussels
argue with you.
And Paris.
I never argue. I'm a very nice person.
But I like arguing with you. That's the thing. You're being nice to me by agreeing to argue with me, even though it's not in your nature.
Okay, then I argue with you.
So, Turkey, thank you so much for putting down your controller long enough to come talk to us. You've been deep into Fallout 4.
No, not deep enough. It's only 70 hours.
It's okay. This show is just going to be about an hour, and then you can go back to it. I'm sure. So thanks for being in Turkey, of course, from Saudi Arabia, as usual. Another regular is Paul, who's joining us from Hong Kong. How's it going, Paul?
It's going good, except I'm not playing Fallout 4, so it could be going better.
Yeah. Why? Why are you not playing Fallout 4?
I don't have a system, a new console, or anything capable of playing that as of yet. Maybe next year, maybe Santa will be nice. We'll see.
You don't have a PC?
I do not have a PC anymore.
Well, that's your problem right there. It's easy to fix. Or, you know, you could install Windows on your Mac via Bootcamp.
Yeah, I've tried that before. My Mac's a little bit aging, so I don't think that's going to work for me either.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, Santa could bring you a PlayStation or an Xbox possibly at Christmas, so we'll see. Please let us know how it goes. So thank you for joining us, as I said, from Hong Kong. And we also have a newcomer. Nima is here with us. How's it going, Nima?
Great. Yep. Happy to be here.
Thanks. You're in a very special position here on the show because you are both from Iran, which is where you are originally from, and you're also living in Boston right now. So you're basically representing Iran and the United States on the show.
Yeah, weird combination, but I'll try to make it work.
Can you just, since I think a lot of listeners will know who Turkey and Paul are, can you just tell us just a little bit about yourself, you know, where you come from, what you're doing in a couple of minutes?
Right. So I'm 28. I was born in Iran. I came to Boston 4 years ago to get my PhD in computer science, and I have been living here since. And yep.
Okay, so basically, is that something that is common? Because I think a lot of people, when they hear Iran, are going to think, well, surely there aren't a lot of Iranians who go to the U.S. especially just to study, right? Is it very common?
Yeah, actually, it's like hugely common. So, there is a national exam for entering universities in Iran that's very competitive. And usually, like, people who get to, like, the top universities there, there's a famous technical university called Sharif University in Tehran. And I would say, like 70-80% of the graduates of their undergrad programs, like, usually go to US for their PhDs and masters. And actually, okay, a good chunk of them end up staying in US.
So how do we reconcile this fact with the very clear knowledge that Iran considers the US the great Satan and that everything they do destroys, you know, the world and morality? When you get back home, don't people like throw stuff at you because you're contaminated with the US?
No, actually, like in Iran, like the people like generally like US, and I understand like it's complex, but like
So it's more, what you're saying is that not all Iranians think in the same exact way in the way that we perceive Iran, I guess.
I guess so, yep. So I guess in the mind of people, there is a separation between like the government policies of the United States and the actual country. Like, people know it's a country of like opportunities, and like lots of immigrants come here and like build their life and are successful. So obviously they're interested in that. But the state media like is really opposed to some of the policies of US, like supporting Israel, or I don't know, like some of the actions of US in the Middle East that they call them unnecessary interventions. So,
okay.
And some of the people like accept that, some of people don't, but generally like US is considered a good place to be, I guess.
Oh, that, you know, that I wouldn't have expected actually, that generally there's a positive feeling towards the US. That is very surprising to me.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, learn something new every day. All right. So let's get into the discussions. Thanks for being here, Nima.
Sure. Let's
get into the discussions about the main, I think, what is going to be the main topic of the day, which is the attacks in Paris, the terrorist attacks in Paris. And that followed, you know, I guess 10 months after the attacks at Charlie Hebdo. Obviously, it was incredibly traumatic. And I've said that this on a few shows already, but it was very, I was very thankful for having so many people sending well wishes and inquiring about my health and that of my close friends and family. And it was obviously a difficult time. It's still pretty difficult. And I want to give you guys, the listeners, a picture of how this has been received. But I'm not sure I want to start with our vision. I would like to turn to Turkey first and ask how the event was seen and discussed in Saudi Arabia.
Patrick, I think it's like most of the world, with the shock and disgust with the majority of people here. The media has been covering it very extensively, and as far as I know from all the interactions I had, whether it was online, in person, people were really shocked and very disgusted at what happened. It's, at the end of the day, it's just some crazy people running around and shooting and killing people at random. And that's clearly they're not... They really don't care who they're ending up killing, whether they're women, children, men, whether they're Muslims, Christians, or atheists, or whatever. It's just a terrorist act, pure and simple.
You know, it's. I'll get back to the question of Saudi Arabia specifically because it's been mentioned in the subsequent coverage. But I think there's one element that is significantly different from the attacks on Charlie Hebdo in the beginning of the year, which has also been reflected in the way we discuss it and approach this event, is that for Charlie Hebdo, the target was as appalling as the act was, there could be some kind of intellectual rationalization behind the act, which was this newspaper had been insulting the prophet, and so we had to retaliate because it was an unbearable affront. And that was something that became a discussion, not to the point that we said, well, then we understand the attack, obviously not. But also when we discussed things with Mahmoud after the Charlie Hebdo attack, he mentioned that one of the reactions was, well, of course, this is despicable, but it's to be expected when you go pushing people's buttons. There's going to be a reaction. And we discussed the nature of insults and how the reactions to insults are usually crafted in the Arab world or in parts of the Arab world, which helped us sort of understand some of the reactions to the attacks in some respects. And I'd encourage people listening now, if they haven't heard it, it's the one from January, the Phileas Club from January. It was pretty interesting to hear these comments as well. But long-winded answer to say, this feels different here as well, because there's no one that can take the side of the terrorists, basically. There's no shred of justification you can give to what they've done, even in the way that they did for Charlie Hebdo. I'm guessing there's the same kind of differences for you guys in Saudi Arabia?
Well, yeah, basically, yeah, that's true. You would have had a reaction during Charlie Hebdo that people would say, what did they expect? They insulted the prophet. Something would have happened. This is, they should have known something like this could happen. And they were people like that, definitely. And in every part of the world. But at the end of the day, let's be honest, the fact that these people actually went and made a big deal out of this and attacked those artists and publishers and made them martyrs for their cause, you just made what they did even more popular and more in demand than scaring people. So basically, and this is within my circle, we do believe that if you see something like that, if someone insults you or something, just ignore them. That's how you just kill the whole thing, because if you give them value, they will continue doing what they want. And that's the same thing with terrorists, and that's how terrorists work. Terrorism is also about trying to scare people, trying to make people change the way they live, trying to impose government being able to monitor your emails, monitor your phone calls, trying to get the government horrified, profiling people. And that's when the terrorism wins, because that's exactly what they want. Terrorism
and
is
you're
basically
saying this is a common because that's something that we are discussing here in France, and the overreactions have been significant. Well, maybe not overreactions, but the discussions are veering towards overreaction, I think. But this is also the way you would approach it in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the ways we approach it in Saudi Arabia. And it's the same situation as you're approaching it in France. You have those who would say, no, we need to do more monitoring. You have those others who are coming out and saying, no, if we do that, we're actually giving the terrorists what they want when we start profiling people, because this is terror. Terrorism is based on the word terror, and basically that's what they did. They terrorized us to the point that we are actually now profiling people, we're monitoring people, we're trying to figure what's going on, and that's the problem. So it's really a situation that everybody goes through, and in Saudi we go through this also. We are in Saudi also a target for ISIS. I believe every country in this world is a target. I don't believe that there's hardly any country in this world that isn't a target for ISIS, whether it's France, whether it's Saudi, whether it's Hong Kong, whether it's Iran, whether it's U.S., it's all a target, because these are terrorists. They really don't care who they're targeting as long as they have their own agenda.
All right. I want to go back to this whole discussion. But before that, Paul, you live really far away from all of this. So surely, you know, the people in Hong Kong don't really care about all of this. They're just going around eating, you know, bowls of noodles in the street and looking at very flashy electric signs that blind everyone because there are so many. Right. That's what keeps happening in Hong Kong.
Well, you would think that, but this was pretty big news over here. And there is a connection.
Damn it, all of you keep contradicting my stereotypes. I'm getting very angry now.
All right, we live to do so. But yeah, in China, actually, they have a very large Muslim population. Part of the several of the ethnic minorities in China, like the Hui and the Uyghurs, are Muslims. And so out in Xinjiang, they have all these tensions going on. Some of this is a carryover. Some of these groups in Xinjiang are being tied now to ISIS in some way, shape, or form. And there have been attacks. There hasn't been any attack in Hong Kong, but there wasn't there was a knifing attack that happened, I believe, up in Shenzhen, which is just north of Hong Kong. And there have been several attacks out in the western region in China. Now, these tend to be much smaller scale than, of course, what happened in Paris. But the fact that these are happening, too, again, you know, gets back to this idea of trying to spread the message, basically, through fear.
You know, that's one thing that we, I mean, there was an attack in Lebanon the day before the one in Paris. There have been attacks here and there, but obviously there was some level of criticism that we don't realize that other countries are also being attacked. And in some countries, those acts are a lot more lethal and widespread than they would be in France. But I also think there is something to be said for cultural closeness. Obviously, if it happens to your neighbor, it's going to mean more to you than if it happens to someone who lives 100, you know, kilometers away.
Well, actually, Patrick, it's more about people expect this to happen in Lebanon. People expect this to happen in Iraq. People don't expect this to happen in France. That's how the people are reacting. It's when they hear about the bombing in Lebanon, unfortunately, it's really sad that people expect it. And all right, this is something that happens regularly. They're sad, they're horrified, but they expect it. They're not shocked. What happened in Paris shocked people. I think that's what's the difference between all of these. Mm.
Certainly, yeah, it probably plays a role for sure. Nima, what about Iran? How was this discussed? I honestly have no idea.
So, yeah, actually, continuing the discussion, like, it was very discussed about, and there were, like, many people who, like, I don't know, like, changed their Facebook picture with the background of French flag.
Oh, so first piece of information, you're heavy users of Facebook in Iran.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Despite it is, like, censored, but, like, people use VPN and get on it, so.
Really? Okay.
Yep. And, yeah, so, yeah, I would say Facebook is pretty popular. And, but there were also these people that were saying, like, Why didn't you do the same for, like, Lebanon or Syria when just recently they had, like, similar attacks with deaths and casualties? And then the first group would come and say, okay, so because it's, like, not very common in the same thing you guys were mentioning. So so there was certainly this, like, clash between these two groups. And yep.
But in general, for the you know, the Daesh and, oh, actually, maybe some Turkey, you can explain to me why they hate being called Daesh and they want to be called ISIS or ISIL, because no. Daesh means something different in Arabic. That's what we've been hearing. It annoys them when we call Daesh.
I've never heard that. They officially call themselves Daesh. It's an abbreviation of their Arabic name, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria.
Okay, there was some rumor going around that they didn't like it and that we actually were, you know, sticking it to them by calling them Daesh, I guess.
I highly doubt it. I don't. Okay. As far as I know, that's what they call themselves. Although they usually just call themselves Islamic State, so that's what they prefer.
Right. Yes, okay.
But they did use Daesh officially at the beginning when they started the movement.
Okay. And so, yeah, going back to Iran, Nima, how is the relationship, because obviously you're a lot closer to all of this in Iran, How is this regarded in general, and the rise of the Islamic State, and you know those events that led to those attacks?
So yeah, basically, it is like condemned. The attacks were condemned by the media and like the government in Iran, and so I don't know. The whole ISIS situation is a complex issue. Like in Iran, I guess most people think, I don't know what most people think, but there's certainly this view that basically what happened was that, like, after Iraq was destabilized after the U.S. attack, and some countries like Turkey and maybe Saudi Arabia, they were like, of course, Iran and Syria, like the current regime, the Assad regime, are good allies. So they tried to topple the Syrian government. And in the meanwhile, they supported the Free Syrian Army in Syria, but somehow ISIS emerged as its own entity, and kind of the whole broke out.
So basically there's a view of the responsibility, I guess, of the war in Iraq, which I'm sure everyone agrees is a factor, at least. And something which we have been discussing as well in France is the role of Saudi Arabia and some other countries. But there's, I guess, a couple of things. First, the financial role of Saudi Arabia financing some of the oppositions to the Syrian regime, and maybe even, you know, the radical groups, and playing with fire. And the other thing is the role of radical, you know, an extreme version of Islam, because I think the world would agree that Saudi Arabia has a very strict interpretation of Islam. And that sort of leads to pulling the Muslim world into that strict interpretation. I'm not sure how Iran plays into that picture, but...
So I doubt that Saudi Arabia's the government like supports the like things that are happening, but I think like maybe like there are some private parties that, because of their ideologies, like they might support, like, I mean, like, they might support and give funding to like ISIS or something, but
and that's basically what we've been hearing about here in France as well, with the sort of finger pointing of, all of a sudden, you know, they are Saudi Arabia is our friend and we're working with them for this and that, and it's the case for the US as well, and all of a sudden now we're realizing, oh, there's this and that that's happening, why were we not condemning it in the first place?
No, actually, like, this is not my view, but it was like maybe in like the state propaganda, it was also mentioned that, like, in the like more hardliner media, that what happened to France, maybe France was kind of responsible for it, because they supported basically Free Syrian Army in Syria, and they helped the emergence of they involuntarily help emergence of ISIS by doing that. Mm. So
basically, yeah. opposing Assad led to,
yeah. So Assad regime, like, I just wanted to mention this too. It's, I think you said like Saudi Arabia supports Assad regime. I think they don't. So. So the
I was talking about the opposition.
So
because obviously, I mean, just to again jump into the very easy views of the world, well, I think this one is warranted to an extent. Basically, Saudi Arabia is Sunni and Iran is predominantly Shiite, and you both hate each other's guts, right? Turkey and Nima, since you're members of those countries and of those...
Unfortunately, that's true. At least on the very high level.
Unfortunately, you said that's true?
Yes.
Okay.
At least on a high level. At least on a high level.
Yeah, there is also... I think like for Iranians, there is like this history of basically how Iran got... A Muslim country was attacked by at the time, I don't know, it wasn't like Saudi Arabia, but basically
the Arabs.
Yep. Yeah, so it was attacked by them, and then we kind of like it's like heritage or pride as the Persian Empire. So we secretly like despise that, but again we consider ourselves like Muslim too, so, and we kind of build up this Shia as a way of distinguishing ourselves from the original, basically
Sunni Muslims. So. Yeah.
But what makes this the situation in Syria more complex, I think, is that actually like the Syria, like the Assad regime, is Sunni too. But we support them.
Well, actually, Assad regime is not Sunni. They're Alawis.
I didn't know that.
It's a Shia sect. It's some type of Shia sect.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yes. So that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, Turkey.
You know, it's true. This is a real big problem. But however, Saudi Arabia, in no way or form, there are individuals who would support Daesh in their own way. They would smuggle money. They would smuggle recruits and so on. There's always individuals. But Daesh is an anti-Saudi government movement. They oppose the monarchy. They oppose the Saudi government. And one of their agenda, the top of their agenda, is to overthrow the monarchy and establish an Islamic state in Saudi Arabia to take over both the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina. So, and Saudi Arabia would never, as a government, support a movement as Daesh, and knowing that they would turn on them in a moment's notice. And I think they already took their lesson, unless they're really stupid, from Afghanistan and the Qaeda.
And the what?
Al-Qaeda.
Sorry. You mean Al-Qaeda, right?
Yes.
Okay. Can't you speak properly, Turkey? This is so annoying.
I'm speaking
annoying
Arabic. Al-Qaeda is Arabic.
But so one other thing that's been discussed is basically the severity of the Saudi Arabian regime, with punishments going so far as, you know, beheadings and stonings and all of those, which are, you know, it's difficult to reconcile the idea that we don't want to support extreme views of Islam, even though, you know, I'm not suggesting Saudi Arabia has views that are similar to that of the terrorists, but it is a very harsh application of Islam. Is
how old is your state, Patrick?
My state?
Yes.
It depends how far you want to go, but I guess the if you want to go to the revolution, it would be 200, a little bit over 200 years.
And when did you abolish capital punishment?
I sense you have the response was prepared, but I see where you're going, and it does make sense. But yeah, capital punishment was probably in the 50s, something like that.
So you're judging a 70-year-old country on the moralities of a country that had hundreds of years to establish itself and its moralities and views.
I guess, yes.
And how does that work? Seriously. So you expect a country that's only 80 years old or less, and to be honest, to be a modern country, it's even less, like it's maybe 50 years old or less as a modern country in a modern society, and that's how old it is, and you expect it to change within 50 years while it took you a few hundred years to change yourselves.
I guess, yeah, there could be a discussion about this, but certainly I understand your point, and it does make sense. Nima, yeah, you were...
Does the U.S., of U.S., United States of America, do they still have the capital punishment?
I don't think they exercise their right in the same way.
Last week, a month ago, they had one. Mm. They still have it on the books. They still have laws that say you can shoot anybody that comes on your property if you feel like it.
I get your point.
So to come and judge Saudi Arabia, which is like 80 years, and then you forget everybody else, and this is only in Saudi, or judging Iran, or judging any country that's very young, and telling that they have to follow your morality, this is a problem. Does the Saudi government go out and support and pay money to ISIS or Daesh or whatever you want to call them, and tells them go and blow up people in Paris, go blow up people in Washington or New York or Amsterdam, anywhere? Do they do that? No, they don't. Mm. So what they do within their own country, within their own borders, that's up to the people to revolt against it and fix it. The population of Saudi Arabia, the people of Saudi Arabia need to fix what they have within their borders, not people from outside their borders coming in and say, you know, this is how you're supposed to treat your people within your borders.
I would argue that in the same way, people in France would say, well, given what's happening, I mean, some people, there would be two approaches. Some people would say, we don't need to go out and do business with a regime whose morality or, you know, laws, let's say, leave morality out of it, but laws, we disagree with. And some people would say the opposite, basically saying the influence that we can have on those countries can be beneficial to the cultural evolution of the country. And also, we can make a good chunk of money selling planes and stuff like that. And we need the oil. So, but Nima, I sensed you were trying to say something at one point.
Yeah, I think I kind of forgot. But what I wanted to mention about basically saying how old is the country, it in some respect it does make sense. But Sharia law or the Islamic government is has a 1400-year-old. Precedence. So,
yeah, but if we go like that, France is 2,000 or more years old. We can go back. Well, maybe 1,000.
No, I guess you guys are based on
well, we have Greek and
Renaissance. Renaissance has started, you guys, maybe.
I would argue it goes a little bit farther.
They had Bible law.
Well, yeah, if you go with the Christian era, it goes obviously at 2,000 years. But yeah, if we can establish the establishment of the French government as an independent entity anywhere between, I guess, the Gauls, which would be before Jesus Christ, or somewhere around 400 or 500 when the first Frank kings actually started exercising at the fall of the Roman Empire, basically, more or less. But there are lots of different ways to look at it.
And also I wanted to mention basically the arguments that I guess it's similar in both in Saudi and Iran, that the government itself doesn't support and stuff like that. But the problem I think is the atmosphere that is caused by the strict application of Islamic views causes individuals to be extremists.
And yeah, there's been a lot of that in France as well, for sure.
Yeah, so I don't know. That's one thing to consider. Mm.
Yeah. Paul, you're very outside of the conversation. Are you? Is it the case that in Hong Kong, it's also kind of you mentioned there's a lot of Muslims in China, but Is it sort of a foreign thing as well? We discuss it when there's a terrorist attack, but ISIS is kind of far away otherwise?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we do have a pretty strong Muslim community. We have, you know, several active mosques here, but those are just outside of the circles that I move with, and I don't have a lot of contact. I've had a couple Muslim students in the past, but no real direct contact. So I think that within those communities, these are probably very big issues that are discussed quite a lot, but not until we get one of the bigger media events like this does it really pop up.
How do you think a Chinese person would, or, you know, someone from Hong Kong, I guess it is China now, but would react to those discussions? Is it completely, all right, that doesn't really concern me, but sure, it's interesting. Or would they be concerned by the thing? I mean, I'm just trying to get a view of how foreign it is for you guys.
Yeah, I think for the general Hong Konger, it's very, very foreign. fortunately, Hong Kong has not, you know, had the misfortune to have an attack like this. So they don't have direct experience. But people in China, if you're out in Western China, and again, they've had an incident in Shenzhen, which is not too far from here, but still it's you have go through border control and it's a slightly removed. So for the average Hong Konger, I think that this is, you know, something they see in the news, but they fortunately don't have much experience with directly.
Yeah, and we have to remember that China is so large that the western part is a lot closer to the Middle East than Hong Kong. So before we move on, I think I would like to discuss the question you sort of alluded to, Turkey, which is that of the reaction with the increased, you know, surveillance and state of emergency, which is supposed to last for 12 days normally in France, and the government had it extended to 3 months. And we have a lot of something that I think the most of the population agrees with, which is basically there's no need for legal approval. Judicial approval for police raids and perquisition. Basically going in a house and search and seizures and things like that. You can just go in and do it. And I think for the first week or so, everyone was saying, yes, no problem, just do it. With the understanding that this was expanded for 3 months and not, you know, forever. But now we're already starting to see people say, all right, let's take a breath and realize that there are some instances of abuses in those acts, and there are a couple of newspapers that set up observatories of the state of emergency to sort of make sure that things are accounted for and make sure that we don't go overboard. Some search and seizures and entering people's houses when it wasn't warranted at all. I'm sorry for the pun, but it wasn't warranted. It was a mistake, an actual mistake, and I think we all understand some mistakes are going to happen. But we also are starting timidly to want to make sure that we don't go overboard there. The thing that we're not quite as concerned about is everything that is in the digital space. And we already have laws that were voted after the Charlie Hebdo attacks that increase the power of the government tremendously to an extent that I don't think is healthy for a democracy. It's not, you know, bringing it down quite yet, but it's unhealthy. It goes in the wrong direction. And there are people who are mentioning the question of backdoor into encrypted messaging. There were a couple of people suggesting, well, see, if they have encrypted messaging, they can coordinate these kinds of attacks. And another thing that came in the same breath almost was, surely they were refugees that came with the refugees from, you know, Syria. And And we discovered relatively quickly that, first of all, one person, I think, came with a refugee passport through Belgium. Everyone seems to be going through Belgium. But there was one person that had a refugee passport, but they were like eight, and the other ones were just French nationals that came back after a trip in Syria. And the other thing is we found communication that, oh, and when I said Syria, my phone thought I meant Siri. No, I wasn't talking to you, Siri. Shut up. Okay. And some of them were using just plain SMS communications to coordinate things, and we still didn't see that coming. So I think the one thing that's going to happen is that hopefully it's going to motivate people to create a PNR, which is the basically flight list sharing and, you know, name flyers, name sharing thing, because currently in Europe, you can't communicate. There's no way to communicate the names of people. So even if they're on one list, then you're not going to know that, you know, if they're in the list in France, the people in Belgium are not going to know that they're people that they should be keeping an eye on. So they just fly in, avoid long international flights, and just go through different countries, and then they can get in without being, located or found. So yeah, there's a lot of discussions about all of this, and I'm guessing these discussions don't reach your shores. You know, the question of what should we do to fix it, I guess, is a right way of asking the question. Do you guys discuss in your countries what should we do to fix it? And let's start with, I guess, you know, Paul, it's not really a problem, right? So there's no discussion.
Well, you know, I do fly back to the U.S. once or twice a year.
Oh, that's a whole other can of worms. So,
yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for the lessons of the U.S. in the post 9/11 world and the Patriot Act, and you know, a lot of the same issues. You know, the ability for different departments to communicate was a big issue, and you know, they ironed out all these things, and then they took it overboard with, you know, NSA and all that kind of nonsense. So My hope is that France can kind of look at the bad example set by a lot of the U.S. blunders in the post 9/11, you know, because they were just kind of stumbling around, you know. It heartens me to think that people are already in France saying, wait a minute, you know, let's take a step back and let's not push this too far.
To an extent, they do, but I think there's also a lot of, I mean, we'll see how it evolves. I think they don't look at the real world, quote unquote, and the electronic world in the same way, which I, for the life of me, I don't understand why, but they don't. But there's also a lot of what Turkey was talking about, which is terror. And terror in the sense of fear. And I think we're thinking still now, 2 weeks after the events, out of a place of fear. And when we should be thinking from a place of reason. And there was a lot of Pray for Paris hashtags being shared on Twitter and Facebook and everything. And the way I look at it is there were some reactions of, you know, we don't really need more religion now. And that was interesting because it was a lot of French people who don't understand that this is just how people from around the world will just express the concern for you. And it's like, I think I mentioned it somewhere, but it was like people were seeing that you were sad, and there was a kid that would come with a flower, and they would give it to you, and you would slap the flower out of their hand and go like, that flower is not going to bring me back my, you know, sister. And you're like, dude, they're just saying pray for Paris because they're sorry, and that's the way they express concern. But at the same time, I would say I'd like to pray for reason, because currently we're not thinking out of reason. We're thinking out of fear. And in that sense, Turkey, you're right. They are maybe not winning, but they're achieving some of their objective. They're pushing us to fear and to thinking and making decisions out of fear, which is the best way of changing who we are. So they can't. There's no way they can kill us. They can't defeat us militarily.
And not only is that, Patrick, they are also helping, you are helping them, we are helping them, all of our governments are helping them in recruiting more people. When France and the U.S. and Europe start discriminating between Muslim and non-Muslim or Arab and non-Arab, and you start treating the people differently, then you're helping these terrorists to recruit more people to join them because they feel out and they would like to look for something where they feel in. And that's how those terrorists are working. They're recruiting people and these governments, Western governments, Arab governments, all governments in the world, a lot of them are falling very easily in their hands and helping them recruit people.
Hey, Nima, as an Iranian national living in the U.S., is that something what Turkey is talking about? Is that something that rings true to you? I mean, I'm sure you're having a good life. You've spent 4 years there now. But how does that work for you as an Iranian in the U.S.? It feels like it should be, you know, oil and vinegar, and it shouldn't. There would be issues mixing them.
Regarding like how people like behave toward me or something like that.
Yeah, I guess something like that. Do you feel any kind of racism? Did you feel like, you know, when these terrorist attacks happened, people looked at you differently because they're, you know, you come from roughly over there and you're, I don't know, just how it feels being from Iran and living in Boston?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you mentioned that. Now I noticed, like, in the past 2 weeks, I just get, like, lots of direct eye contact for some reason from strangers.
Really?
But, yeah.
You mean people looking at you intently?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, actually, I just noticed that. Okay, anyway, but actually, I'm very surprised, like, how, in general, U.S. people are open to immigrants and other cultures. And I guess, like, in general, they're very supportive of other nationals. And
and it's a case for, it's your experience for you as well in the past years?
Mostly, yes. During our last president, like Ahmadinejad, like whenever I tell somebody I'm from Iran, they would say, like, what's your view on Ahmadinejad, and like, why is he saying that? And that was kind of weird, frustrating. It was like, I don't know, Trump becoming the president of US, and then do you have to answer for him? So
was it that bad? I mean, the comparison between Trump and Ahmadinejad are you think that they are apt? You're not exaggerating, because for me, Trump seems like someone that is. I just cannot understand how this is happening.
That was exactly what happened in Iran. But the problem in Iran was that we have a very short vetting cycle in our presidential election. It's basically just 1 month. So, like, he came out of nowhere, nobody knew him, and he just got sudden popularity, but by saying some populist, like, ideas, and then he got elected.
And so that was...
Fortunately, the same wouldn't happen, hopefully, in U.S., because, like, you have to just run for 1 year, and... I mean, sometimes, like, people here say, oh, the election process is, like, so long and boring and stuff. But I think, in general, that's a good thing, because hopefully it will avoid cases like what happened to us. So,
and so, yeah.
I don't know. I got quite a few similar conversations when Bush was elected back in 2000 when I moved over here. People were always asking me, why is he saying that? What is he saying? What is he talking about? He sounds dumb.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's interesting that, yeah, people would look at you. But, you know, it's also natural. I mean, I'm trying to play the role of the everyday person here. And if, you know, I met you, Nima, I would probably, you know, you're from Iran. You're sort of, you can talk about the person that is supposedly representing the country better than anyone else. So I would probably ask you, what's up with Ahmadinejad, I guess. But it's heartwarming to hear that you're saying, you know, the Americans are welcoming to you, because that's not always the image we have of Americans. And maybe it's because, you know, Boston is different from the rest of the country. But it's also, I think, what Turkey you were saying when you were talking about your experience in the U.S., your experience was very different from what we might have heard from what happened during the, you know, the days and weeks and months that followed 9/11. So,
yeah, definitely.
So, so Nima, it's not, you know, you haven't all of a sudden 2 weeks ago started getting, I don't know, your life in the U.S. hasn't changed suddenly.
No, after September 11, like some of the Iranian students here like were contacted by I guess FBI agents, and like they were basically would come and ask you, what are you doing here, what's your research and stuff like that. But I haven't heard the same after the Paris attack. So.
Yeah, I'm sure if there was an attack in the U.S., God forbid, it would, you know, happen again. But that's, I think coming and asking questions is warranted, and I'm sure it's happening in France as well. We have people being assigned to residence and things like that, and it's important that we make sure it doesn't go overboard, and we have the, you know, people looking at it to point out when there are issues. But I think it's to be expected in that regard. Guantanamo Bay is a different question, but we could have a debate about that.
Patrick, can I ask a question really quick?
Oh, of course. Please do.
You know, one of the things that constantly is on my mind as I hear people talking about these issues is the use of the word terrorism and terrorist. And I think that this word has been overly inflated by the media, so I'd be curious to hear what, you know, the others here have to say about it, because I look at this as criminal behavior, and I just see it as a group of criminals, right? I mean, they may have an agenda, it may be tied to an ideology, but why is it any different from a gang of bank robbers who go into a bank and kill a bunch of people because they want money? You know, at the end of the day, it's they want something, they're willing to hurt people to get that thing, whatever it is, whether it's physical or ideological. They break the law, they're criminals. I mean, part of me thinks that the whole labeling and when you label, again, you get into the separation and, you know, the division of people. And I just think that it's kind of gone a bit too far, and we should just get back to the idea of, you know, okay, these guys did bad stuff. They're criminals. Let's just, you know, pursue them and hunt them down and treat them like criminals.
Mm. You mean they're not worse than anyone else who would go and kill 100 people?
Right, for whatever means, you know. I mean, yeah. people who don't do home invasion, you know, they go on a killing spree, or, you know, a guy who, you know, somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer. I mean, they all have their motivations. They all have their reasons for doing it.
I guess, yeah, what you're saying is it's not, yeah, it's if there's a mass shooting somewhere in the U.S., it's just, it should be regarded in more or less the same way. But I think, you know, there's an organization behind it, and the goal of it is to instill fear. So that's how you call it. You know, the terrorist is someone who wants to instill fear, as we discussed before. And just like you said, if you want to be specific, you're going to say it's a bank robber. You're not just going to say it's a criminal. But I sort of get what you understand. We're sort of building up these words into something that makes them scarier than they are. But
I kind of agree with that point of view. But they are, at the end of the day, these people are terrorists, because that's what they're doing. They're trying to make people terrified. They're trying to have terror within this specific country. And however, what's the problem for me? The problem is not that we call these people terrorists, but that we only call these people terrorists. For example, if you have heard about the Parenthood clinic in the U.S., where some guy came in and just shot everybody. It's the same thing. That's terror, because that's a person who went in, and his aim wasn't just to kill people. He wanted to terrorize everybody, so they stopped doing this Planned Parenthood. It's the same concept, but this is a lone gunman, and these are terrorists. So,
right. So you're saying there are other terrorists that we should call terrorists as well, yeah. and not yeah. just the right, right. Yeah, yeah, no, it makes sense.
Yeah, or we call them all criminals. So we can't just. This is my problem with the media. The media separate, and it's not clear. They don't separate because you are a terrorist. No, apparently for some reason nowadays, if you're a Muslim, you become a terrorist, even if you end up killing one person. If you're a Christian or some other religion, you're a lone gunman. And that pisses me off and pisses a lot of people off here as well. And I don't mind. Call him a lone gunman. Call the terrorist who attacked Paris as a lone gunman. Or call them terrorists and call the person who is doing an act of terror, no matter what faith or what organization he follows, as a terrorist.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And there's definitely, you know, I hadn't really looked at it that way. And I understand what both of you guys are saying. There's definitely some validity to it. I mean, but we did call other people terrorists when they were actually a terrorist organization trying to actively instill fear into their, you know, there were the Basque terrorists, there are the Corsican terrorists. Now they're less active, of course.
Yeah,
and we have the IRA. But, they were called terrorists.
Yes, but keep in mind, they were called terrorists because they were anti-government and the government called them terrorists and made the media call them terrorists. That's the difference.
I wouldn't go that far. I honestly think that
they
the
are. No,
okay,
they
okay,
are anti-government. They were anti-government. Were they? Or they
no,
were,
of course.
They not?
Of course, they were anti-government. Of course.
Bring in your organization right now. Let them oppose the government openly and start bombing people. They'll call them terrorists. As long as they're anti-government, they'll call them terrorists. But if they're not anti-government, they're just anti-specific movement or something, they will never call them terrorists.
Hmm. Yeah. That okay. It's an interesting approach to it. I can see it. I can see the validity in it.
And sure. Plus, why don't we call them freedom fighters?
Well, that is a different. I think they call themselves freedom fighters. There's another thing I want to touch on very quickly before we move on. It's the use of the French flag, which has sparked another discussion. Not really heated debate, but at least discussion, because I've seen for the first time in a very long time French flags at windows and, you know, not incredibly many, but there were some. And there were a lot of people starting to say, me included, we have to use the French flag again and to take it back from the nationalists, which have made it a dirty symbol. And let's just use the French flag and make it a proud symbol of our country again. Because currently in France, if you use the French flag, it's kind of suspect. You're kind of like, why do you have a French flag? Are you some kind of nationalistic asshole? And so there was a lot of discussions. And the interesting thing was that even in the context of the terrorist attacks, sorry, Turkey and Paul, I'm calling them terrorists. but in the context of those attacks, they were where, you know, the national pride rises up in everyone. There were still people saying, you know what? I don't really like the French flag. I would like to use a people's flag because the French flag is divisive. Let's use a European flag or let's use a people of the world flag. And that, for me personally, is taking it a little bit too far left. It becomes kind of a tree hugger discussion, kind of like, which I like trees. I'm in, you know, I like ecology. I do stuff. And that's not what I'm saying, but it's kind of like at some point you have to draw the line. And for me, I think, and it's not like they're saying you shouldn't use a flag, but they're saying for myself, I don't want to use the flag because it's divisive and it's for one nation, which leads to, you know, pushing out the outside rather than being inclusive. And for me, I look at it in the way that many other peoples do, which is we can be proud of our country and of our flag and be inclusive and, you know, be welcoming. And that is how we differentiate ourselves and take back the flag and that symbol from the nationalists that make it something a little bit more, you know, dirty and to be looked at with suspicion. So anyway, that also happened. I'm guessing none of you guys have...
Your flag pissed me off a lot.
Why? Why? What did we do now?
Not you. It's the world. They pissed me off when they started lighting the lights and all over these landmarks and the French flag.
Why would you be pissed off by that?
No. Let me finish. I have no problem with that. If they did the same for the Lebanese flag when there was a terrorist attack a day before and hundreds of people died. This is discrimination between different nations.
And the reason is, I think that's where I come to the comparison with the neighbor being attacked. We have a much, you know, the countries where they did that are usually countries that have more cultural
the
proximity.
GCC countries did them also.
The what, sorry?
GCC, Gulf countries, Emirates, Qatar.
Ah, so.
Kuwait, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that's the weird thing.
Yeah.
So both of you guys, Nima and Turkey, thought that was weird.
Yes.
Kind of, yeah.
Yes, I know why it happened, but it pisses me off. They should have at least have shown the same thing to their neighboring country like Lebanon, as they have lost a lot of people in terrorist attack and should have put the lights out.
Nima, you also agree with that, you know, sort of half resentment sentiment of it happened?
Yeah, it's like apparently shows like there is a vast supremacy belief in everybody's mind or something like that. I don't know, like
it kind of shows that the value of the French people's lives was more valuable than the Lebanese life. Sorry.
I mean, there is like analysis here, like that people were saying simply because it happens less in a country like France. It has basically just more journalistic value, like it's like a basics of journalism. So they were like defending it like that. So if something happens like every week, it's not going to be a huge news. Like it can be horrible, but like.
I agree. Like,
That's what you were saying in the beginning, Turkey. Yeah. You were saying it's
not
journalism.
That's for journalism, but
wait. You weren't saying just about journalism earlier. You were saying it's less shocking when it happens a lot,
it's less shocking, but you should feel bad about everybody equally. I'm saying shock. I'm not sure. Yeah. There's a difference between feeling bad about people and feeling sad and annoyed and pissed at what happened and being shocked. That's the difference.
I see.
I'm not shocked when someone blows up 100 people in Lebanon. I'm not shocked. I'm disgusted. I'm sad. I'm upset. I'm pissed. I am shocked when it happens in Paris. And I'm also sad, pissed, and all of that. So that's the difference.
Yeah, I agree. Sorry. Go ahead, Nima.
I just want to say, like, maybe also Facebook here is to blame because they included the flag feature just for France. So.
Yeah, the flag feature is something that they mentioned as well. And they said, you know, both for the safety check, which was immensely useful, and the flag feature, they caught some flack and they said, yes, you're right. We should do it for other events as well. And we will. So I think in that case. But, you know, I understand what both of you guys are saying. And I understand on an intellectual level, it makes complete sense. I also think that there's a lot of sentiment and, you know, feelings involved in this. And it doesn't work quite in the same way. And I don't think it's realistic to expect that for every attack that happens everywhere, it's what you were saying. If we start getting, again, God forbid, if we start getting attacks in Paris every week, even every month, I can guarantee you that there's not going to be a French flag in all on all those monuments every time. So, but yeah. Anyway, all right. I think that was a very enlightening discussion. Let's move on to other things that happened in the world. I'm sure there were interesting things happening in other places as well. And again, in an effort to give Paul the talking stick, is there something that happened in Hong Kong that made the news, maybe more even than the Paris attacks in the past month, that's worth mentioning?
Well, I don't know if it would be more newsworthy or not, but this past November 27th was notable because it's, of course, Black Friday, the biggest physical shopping day of the year in the U.S. But also here in Hong Kong, it marks the 75th birthday of Bruce Lee, who unfortunately is no longer with us, but he would have been 75. And so there's a lot of discussion going on online, a lot of articles relooking at his life and his contributions. And, you know, it's interesting because he was a hero of mine growing up. And in part, he's part of the reason why I am where I am right now.
Are you a martial artist?
No, I studied a little bit when I was younger, but it, really his movies, you know, motivated me. They got me interested in Chinese and learning about China and the language and the culture. And, you know, he wanted to be a bridge and he wanted his films to be a bridge. And so he was in this very interesting position of, you know, being in both worlds, both China, and he was, you know, he had an American birth certificate. So he was able to move fluidly. In some ways, he was kind of one of the first ideas of a true global citizen. And so he's always been very inspirational for me. And, you know, I think that the idea of sort of bringing the world closer together, learning, you know, and to value the cultures of other people through film and just through sharing and talking, even though his films are about fighting and kicking butt, right? But yeah, so, you know, take some time and take a look and read up on some of the things that you might not have known about this guy who unfortunately only made a handful of movies, but they were movies that had a very strong impact on a bunch of us.
For sure. It was, I mean, growing up, Bruce Lee's movies were definitely a thing. And so you're saying it made the news, it was featured prominently in...
Yeah, because it's... It was, you know, he's considered a favored son of Hong Kong because of his legacy. So a lot of articles written locally and some international news coverage as well.
I'm surprised we didn't get any. I of course, you know, because of the events, it got probably eclipsed. But I'm surprised that I didn't hear about it at all. Bruce Lee is definitely one of those figures from my childhood that has a strong influence in the movies and in, you know, popularizing martial arts. And, you know, his son met the same tragic fate. And he's definitely someone that I'm reminded of when you mention it. And I'm like, oh, my God, yes, Bruce Lee. Where has his legacy gone? And it's interesting that it's obviously being mentioned more in Hong Kong. I'd like to turn to the two Middle Easterners on the panel, and ask two things. First of all, are you guys getting Black Friday? And what do you think of it? Or, you know, what the country thinks of it? And do you guys have a knowledge and an understanding of Bruce Lee and his movies? Let's start with Turkey.
Friday, what? Do you think we are disgusting people that do shopping like that? And we go on a Black Friday, a sinful day. We call it here White Friday.
So there are deals and shopping and things happening on White Friday.
It's mostly online. It's nothing. We don't have this cultural day in brick and mortar stores, but online it's becoming very popular, and they're calling it White Friday because apparently some extremists think Black Friday means something completely different. Of these online retailers are now using the word White Friday. Our Friday is white. It's not dark.
It's in France, we get it as well. Also online, mostly, I think, because of all of the, you know, internet giants that are American companies that do those promotions for the Black Friday. And so since they do them for their American site, they figured we'll just follow through in the other countries as well. And yeah, that's how it seeps into our...
We don't have any of those international online retailers here in Saudi.
Oh, really?
Or in the Middle East.
So it's really culturally like osmosis. You actually get it from
local retailers, online retailers. And basically because Black Friday is popular here for most people, especially the geeks and nerds who are online, And they usually do shop from the States, from Amazon and so on Black Friday and ship their stuff here to Saudi. So that's one way to, since it's the Black Friday concept is known for everybody who uses the internet, they started the White Friday movement to try and attract some of that business.
Okay, as what about Bruce Lee? Yeah.
I did not hear about this news, but Bruce Lee, at least for my generation, has been a very big influence, and has, and I think everybody in my generation, or even before my generation, knows him very well. But the news of his birth date, I haven't heard about it.
Okay. Nima, Black Friday, Bruce Lee.
So the Bruce Lee going to be the same as Turkey, pretty much. And Black Friday, no, I can think of two reasons. One, like, because of the, like, sanctions. Like, we don't have Amazon in Iran. And, like, and also, like, the Persian New Year starts at March, like, in the beginning of spring. And usually the months before that is usually when, like, there is, like, all the shopping and people go out and stuff like that.
Okay. All right. So you don't have Black Friday in Iran?
Nope.
Okay. That's too bad. You know, there are really good deals to be had on TVs at Target and blah, blah, blah.
Okay. I'd rather not own anything than stand in line with crazy people and trying to fight them for something.
To save $50 on the $900
thing. Exactly.
You know, Patrick, it's interesting because Turkey mentioned that they renamed it White Friday. China's done the same thing this year. They've renamed it Red Friday.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, because red is considered a more lucky color, I guess, than black. And basically, I guess how it's working, if you're in mainland China, because some of the bigger sales groups like, you know, Google and your Amazons are blocked, so they have these startup apps now who sort of will work as an intermediary so people can get access to the sales, basically. So they're not celebrating Thanksgiving or really buying stuff in lieu of Christmas or anything, but they're just trying to, you know, catch the best deals.
Of course, yeah. Hmm, interesting. Red Friday. I would have thought, you know, it was because of the glory of communism, but it's just the red color. Turkey, did anything interesting happen in Saudi Arabia? We've been hearing about, you know, beheadings and trials and stuff like that.
Well, let's see. We had a lot of rain in the last week. A lot of rain the last week. And a few cities have went underwater. A lot of homes sunk, a lot of cars. Unfortunately, a few deaths.
Wait a second. We're still talking about basically Saudi Arabia, which means the desert, right? You're in the middle of the desert.
Yes. We had so much rain. This last week, we had on average about 80 millimeters of rain. So, and that's really a lot. And unfortunately, a few cities have very poor infrastructure for getting rid of all of this rain that resulted in a lot of flooding. And so on. So that's the biggest thing. Other than that, if you remember, the land tax, a royal decree has been announced where the land tax will be imposed after exactly 1 year from last week.
Oh, I forgot exactly what it was. The land tax was because
it's just to encourage people to sell their land and develop it, because a lot of people here in Saudi buy land and keep it and wait sometimes 20, 30 years. The entire area is built up and there's a lot of empty patches of land that are not used. Like in Riyadh alone, Riyadh is a huge city. It's about 50 kilometers by 50 kilometers in length, and about within the center of the city, maybe 30 to 40% of it is not developed, even though it's 100%, should be 100% developed.
So the land tax is going to encourage people to sell, basically.
Yeah, it's supposed to. I'm waiting and see.
To sell or to develop it.
Yes, either sell it to someone who will develop it or just develop it. So wait and see. At least this is for all housing land.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And finally, Nima, anything happened in Iran worth mentioning?
So, there has been this, of course I'm like kind of curious why nobody mentioned the downing of the Russian jet in Turkey. Like that was.
Oh
like,
yeah, that was a big deal for sure. I guess
like everybody heard about that. But like in Iran, like there has been an interesting development regarding like boycotting the cars made in Iran. Like there is a. Like in Iran, there is a huge tariff on foreign cars, so most people end up. Yeah, and so most people end up buying cars made in Iran, and actually we do have lots of old French cars, like Peugeot 405 is still made in Iran, and yeah, actually I like that car.
Who doesn't? What's the name of are there more than one car manufacturers in Iran?
Yeah, there is like...
Can you tell us their names? It's just, it makes me, you know, I'm interested in that.
Yeah, there's the big one is called Iran Khodro, means like Iran's machine. And the other one is Saipa. And so they have like their prices have increased after the rise of the dollar. The Iranian currency rial has losing lots of value against the dollar after the sanctions in the recent years.
Right.
So subsequently, like the prices have gone up. And the people are not very happy with the quality of the cars.
That's what I was going to ask. Are they like, you know, the Eastern European made cars before the fall of the wall?
Yeah. I think you got the idea. Yeah, like it's like very old models. There's like this car called Pride, which is, I think, used to be a very old model of Fiat. In 1980s that is still produced in Iran, and they're really not safe, and lots of people, I think close to like, we have like a crazy rate of deaths in
car
road
accidents.
Mm-hmm. Like I think like it's more than 10 people per day die in Iran because of the road accidents.
Okay.
And part of it is because of not very good driving habits, but part of it is because of the quality of the cars. So anyway, there was this movement to boycott the cars made in Iran, and so it was like kind of successful, and the government actually ended up offering basically a car loan to everybody so that they would still keep buying cars.
I'm guessing it's as in every country, the car industry, you know, the manufacturing industry is a big part of the economy of the country, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is. Yep. And that was interesting. Like, it showed, like, people, like, I mean, it was like an interesting social movement.
But so you mean, a couple of questions. Can you find cars that are foreign in Iran? Can you find American or Japanese cars in
Iran? Yeah, you can, like, if you have the money, but they're going to be like 140% tax.
Okay, 140%, okay. Interesting.
It means like it's like going to be 3 times, 4 times more.
Yeah.
And there are lots of like Maserati and Tesla and stuff like that in Iran.
Tesla?
I think there is, yeah.
Wow.
And if you're like very wealthy and stuff, like you can definitely import the car you want. But the majority of middle class like have to just buy the car made in Iran. And they have been increasingly becoming more expensive, and the quality is not improving. So that's why.
So, but now the result of the boycott, I'm curious, did the boycott go through social media and the internet? I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was actually like there's a Facebook page for it, like, and Facebook is very popular, and also there's a new messaging app called Telegram.
Which is encrypted.
It's like kind of censorship resistance. Before that, Viber was very popular in Iran, but the government cracked down on Viber, I think. So now Telegram is very popular, and that's, I think, how it was organized to do the boycott and stuff. But eventually, the news of it came to the media, the state media, and it was like there were debates. And
so it did become public because of the way it was transmitted. Yeah.
Initially,
virally.
They tried to portray it as a, like, anti-nationalistic or treason event, something like that. But as it became more popular, they just had to face the fact that it's just a problem that has to be addressed.
So it was transmitted through Telegram. Do they have, I think they have public channels. Chat rooms on Telegram, do they?
Yeah, they have these things called channels.
Right.
So basically you subscribe and it's like you just get the news through it.
Okay.
And yeah, actually it's also a hugely popular Telegram between like Iranian families. Like usually every family like has a Telegram and people on that like say happy birthday and news of the family is shared. It's kind of funny, yeah.
Interesting. And yeah, and so
lots of jokes. We really like jokes.
And those channels are encrypted? Because I know that on Telegram some of the channels are encrypted and some aren't.
So. I think they are. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But... yeah.
Just another question. Those apps are used on Android phones, or do you have iPhones as well? Or
I think we do have iPhones as well, yeah. But most people use Android, I guess.
Okay. Okay. And we could do a whole episode on this, but the phones, how many service providers do you have? Is there one for the state? Is it very, you know, is it easy to get network?
There is a big one for the state. There are like semi-private ones also. There is like one called MTN Irancell, which is, I think the MTN is based in South Africa. It's a South Africa company, so it's a cooperation between those companies. And they offer like rather good like 3G quality service.
Okay.
But of course it's a censored like
The state controls what goes over it, so people use VPNs.
Yeah, like Facebook is censored, of course like pornography sites are web censored. Some of the political sites are censored.
Is Twitter allowed, or is it also blocked?
I think it was censored. Yeah, it is.
And so, okay, and so I'm guessing you use Android phones on the cheaper end, a couple hundred bucks, $100, something like that?
Recently people started to go to the Chinese brand, but... despite the high price, people like Samsung is very popular in Iran.
Oh, interesting.
The Galaxy series, like people like basically have to pay like their 1 month of income to get the phone, but they do.
No, you know, it's very interesting because it's I've heard a lot of people discussing this, you know, the fact that now phones are so important in everyone's life. And of course, it's even more true for people and places where the phone is your only, you know, your main computer and often your only computer. So it's important that you, even if it costs more, you're going to be willing to put in more money to get something that you're going to be using every day that is more, you know, that works better or faster or allows you to do more things. And it's still not the price of a car. So
yeah, exactly. It's still,
All right, cool. Interesting. Thank you very much. And thanks to the three of you for being on the show. I think we're going to close it right now. But before we do, of course, I'm going to ask each of you to let me know where we can find you on the internet, if there is a place that we can find you on the internet. Paul?
You can follow the work that I do over a website. That's kongcast.com, KONGCAST.com. If you're interested in what's happening in Hong Kong, mostly in the entertainment, movie industry, that kind of stuff. And the normal places, Twitter and the Google Plus and Facebook, but, you know, just personal musings and kind of boring stuff. So,
what's your Twitter handle?
Foxlore, F-O-X-L-O-R-E.
Perfect. Nima, do you have a Twitter account people could go follow?
So, yeah, I'm on Twitter, not hugely active, but my handle is NimaAR1. And also on Facebook, it's M25Racer, and which is the name of an old game I used to play when I was a kid. And also, I've started this blog about reviewing some moderately priced, good quality headphones. So if you're interested, it's bigheadguy.wordpress.com.
Wow, very specific. Moderately priced headphones. Cool. So bigheadguy.wordpress.com. Thanks, Nima. And Turkey.
Oh, well, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Turkey Alvalla, TurkiAlvalla.
Perfect, as usual. And for me, it's not Patrick. I'm not Patrick on Twitter. I'm also available on Facebook. I'm also
Patrick, I really need to know, when are you Patrick if you're not Patrick all the time?
That is the mystery that you have to solve. I'm Patrick in real life and not Patrick on the internet. That's the reality of it. And yes, I'm also on FrenchSpin.com, where you can find this show and my other show where we discuss video games every 2 weeks. And of course, I cannot forget about the patrons that make this show, that keep this show going. You can support the show at patreon.com/thephileasclub if you wish to do so. I will gladly take your money and I will be extremely thankful for it. I'm extremely thankful to the almost 200 people that decide this show is valuable enough that it deserves a little bit of cash every month. So thank you so much for supporting it. I can't tell you how much it means that you decide, you know, to spend your hard-earned cash on me and this show rather than on some other things that you would probably bring you more immediate pleasure and satisfactions, like, you know, I don't know, candy and phones and cars and stuff like that. So really, thank you from the bottom of my heart for supporting this show. And, of course, we'll be back in the next one. I'm not sure if we're going to be doing a special episode this month again. I've been creating my company. It's now running, basically. And we've had a few interesting happenings with that, because it turns out I am the first European actual company to start running a business with income from Patreon. So that has led to interesting administrative questions being asked, and we're still in the middle of trying to solve that. So I don't know if I'm going to have the time to do a special episode this month. But
I'm glad your wife is a lawyer.
Yes, so am I. Oh my God, it would be so difficult if she wasn't.
I think you ought to do a special episode on these administrative issues. I'm curious now.
Mostly it has to do with VAT. And, you know, the remittance thereof. But it would be a very, you know, interesting episode for the three people that might have a similar issue in the future. But we'll see. Maybe I'll do another special episode. And if we don't, we'll be back in a month with a regular episode that will celebrate the joy of Christmas. Yes, and the holidays. But Christmas, you know, I celebrate Christmas, even though I'm not really Christian. What's wrong with me? I don't care. It's the happiness of getting and giving gifts. That's what matters. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you again and talk to you again in a month. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.